The Mystic Pete Chronicles.
About Minnie the Moocher, she was a red hot hoochie coocher. She was the roughest, toughest frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Hidey, hidey, hidey,
hidey, hidey, hidey, hidey, hidey.
Him, though he was pokey, he took her down to Chinatown. He showed her how to kick the gong around. Hide, hide,
hide.
Things that she was needing. He gave her a home built of gold and steel, a diamond car with the platinum wheels. Hidey, hidey, hidey,
hidey, hidey, hidey, hidey.
Starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview Susan Loewenberg, producing director of LA Theater Works, latw.org. And then I play an excerpt from one of their signature works, Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis. At the very beginning, I played Minnie the Moocher by Cab Calloway. And at the end of the show, Happy Days Are Here Again by Ben Selvin and his orchestra. Those two tunes are from the time period when Babbitt was written. Stay tuned. Mystic Pete Chronicles. Mystic Pete here with Susan Loewenberg, the producing director for LA Theater Works. Hi, Susan. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Let me allow you to introduce yourself and introduce LATW. LATW.org for more information and explain what's happening.
LA Theater Works is celebrating its 51st year in business. We have evolved over the years. One of the things I think that's been exciting for me and sort of kept me very much interested in my organization is how the organization has changed over the years. You know, when we started 51 years ago, we started as an organization called Artists in Prison. And what we were an organization that did workshops with inmates, first at the county jail, and then we segued into the state prison system and eventually into the federal system. We worked at Terminal Island, for example, for many, many, many years. And I think one of the things that has kept me so engaged with my organization is how many transitions, successful transitions, we've been able to achieve going from an arts in prison organization to an organization now that has accumulated recordings of over almost 600 plays, theater plays. We like to think the best of the classic group of plays and also some fabulous work by new and upcoming writers. We now have this unique library of almost 600 recordings. We have evolved from being an organization that did workshops in prisons to our present mission, which is, of course, is to record the best of American and international theater. And we have the largest library of its kind in the world. And we are thrilled to be able to, we have a weekly radio show on the on public radio stations throughout the United States. We have a streaming service, which is fairly new, where we're able to stream any piece, and you can go on latw.org and stream any play in our library of almost 600 plays. We're heard all over the world. I just got a lovely note from a gentleman in Pakistan who told me how much he was enjoying listening to LA Theater Works. And we're able to, we have a huge program with schools. We have over 2,000 teachers that we work with all over the United States, and we send them free recordings, which are appropriate for the junior and high school curricula. You know, I think one of the things that's exciting is figuring out all of the different ways that we can enable people to access great theater, no matter where they are. They can be in the middle of nowhere and get access to a terrific play at LA Theater Works. And the other thing, of course, it's been very rewarding is working with its fabulous theater artists, the actors, the directors, the sound designers. And we have probably worked with over 2,500 actors in the course of this journey. And that's been so rewarding and exciting. And it's everybody from an up and coming young actor to, you know, household names, the Richard Dreyfusses, Marsha Mason, Ed Asner, Hector Elizondo, the classic names, and then the fabulous up and coming artists that we are able to work with. So it's a lot of fun. I hope that we are delivering a needed service to people. You know, if you don't have access to live theater, this is the next best thing.
Well, you're also working with some very notable arts organizations. Care to mention a few of those?
Yeah, I mean, we work with theaters all over the country because our fellow regional theaters get, for example, during the pandemic, we were able to send, you know, people needed something to keep their patrons engaged. And we did a project where we just gave free recordings to all of the theaters that wanted them all over the country. And that was a rewarding experience for us. And I hope it was helpful to theaters to keep their people engaged. One of the things that I'm proud of is that we've been able to supply people with rich cultural experiences because of what we do and the way in which we do it. We're broadcast all over the United States, but you can hear our broadcast. If you go online, you can just hear the weekly broadcast and anywhere in the world. We're very honored to be able to provide cultural enrichment in the way that we do, as we say, anywhere, any place, any time.
Well, let's zoom out a second and consider where this belongs in our cultural timeline right now. I think a lot of particularly young people are getting media or their arts from social media. And they're used to a certain presentation, maybe a 15 or 30 second blip in their life. And it has to be quick and fast and punchy, maybe very sexual or disturbing. You know, for a lot of people, that's theater these days. And perhaps when younger people think of theater, they think of it some antique, some kind of older style thing that their parents went to. What are you finding with school children? Are they open to, you know, a longer format play? That play may go on for an hour or two or longer. How are they? Are they receptive? Do they have the capacity to concentrate? What's happening with this transmission to the next generation?
I think that fortunately, because we have this relationship with over 2,000 teachers, our teachers have been a wonderful bridge, and they have been able to introduce kids to what we do. And I think, for example, one of our biggest single seller is Arthur Miller's The Crucible. Now, The Crucible, you know, it's a tough read for kids. It's a very tough read. And what happened was somehow the kids discovered that The Crucible was available as an audio recording. I cannot tell you, it is our biggest single seller. I cannot tell you how many thousands of kids have accessed The Crucible through LA Theater Works. And it's so much for young people. I think being able to access that recording, then they can go back and read it. But the introduction through the live recording has been, I mean, I cannot tell you how many letters we've gotten from students, from teachers, you know, you changed my life, basically, because there's something about being able, with certain kinds of material, to be able to listen is a very good way to introduce a young person to important literature. It's more, I think, engaging than just reading a Shakespeare play or a Tennessee Williams play. Because theater is meant, of course, as we know, theater is meant to be experienced as a live event. And this is a way, if you can't actually attend a live theater performance, this is a very, very good way, a very engaging way to experience theater is by listening to an audio recording.
Yeah, I think when it's being presented by capable actors, it really makes it compelling and it draws you in. I'm just finishing The Seagull by LA Theater Works. You have Calista Flockhart. I mean, It's a powerful piece to begin with, but then you have these engaging actors that really draw you in. So, yes.
Yes. And you know, being in Hollywood, being where we are, we've had access to some of the world's most important and well-known actors. And that's been, of course, a terrific, terrific way for us to engage with the public, because we've got, you know, we have some of the most famous actors in the world doing our recordings. And for them, it's also terrific. They can go into a studio and in 3, 4, 5 days, do an impressive recording. And so people are very willing to do that.
Well, since Lucy has signed me up to interview you, I've listened to the following LA Theater Works productions: Frankenstein, Dracula, Babbitt, Oedipus the King, The Jungle, The Idiot, Brothers Karamazov, and The Seagull, catching up on some of my Russian literature. But I will say, listening to Babbitt all, what, about 12 hours?
14 hours.
Listening to all 14 hours of Babbitt, which I'd never read, and I'd never read Sinclair Lewis, it was, frankly, a life-changing experience. I mean, with Ed Asner at the helm of that production, I mean, what a powerful performance. I didn't realize the beauty of the language that this writer, it was wonderful. It was elevating.
Well, I have to tell you that Babbitt was actually our first project. Babbitt launched the new phase of LA Theater Works. What happened was, I'll give you a little brief history. I got a phone call. LA Theater Works had been doing, you know, live theater, and, you know, it was just, we were a typical small theater company. And I got a call one day from the wife of the great actor René Auberginois. Her name is Judith Auberginois. And she said to me, you know, we've been watching LA Theater Works theater work in small theaters around town. And I have assembled a group of very famous actors. And she rattled off, you know, Richard Dreyfuss, Marcia Mason, René Auberginois, Hector Elizondo, et cetera, et cetera. And we're very interested in perhaps doing something with you. And I thought, oh, well, okay, we'll explore that. That's interesting. Long story short, the actors came together, and the idea originally was that they were going to form a repertory company and do something like be another Mark Taper Forum. And that didn't happen. And one day, Richard Dreyfuss said, you know, I've always been interested in radio drama. And there's a station called KCRW, and a woman named Ruth Seymour runs the station. And why don't we go and talk to her? And I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. Long story short, Ruth was very excited about it. And she proposed that we do a major project. And I had always loved Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt. I was a big fan of his. And so I suggested this piece, Babbitt. And of course, who was the perfect actor to play the lead? Ed Asner, right? As Babbitt. And at that time, the company consisted of 28 actors, and all of them participated. It took us a year. We recorded the book word for word. Every time a character came up, it was played by an actor. The same actor played the same character throughout. Plus, they split up the narration. Took us a year to do this at KCRW and another few months to edit it. And then Ruth aired it on Thanksgiving Day in 1980-something. And she aired it as a 14-hour special on Thanksgiving Day, and it exploded. It just was a sensation. And then NPR got in touch with us and said they wanted to air it. So they aired it in 3-hour segments every week. That was it. That put us on the map. And then we were asked by the Arthur Miller folks if we wanted to do The Crucible. And that, of course, became our first major, after Babbitt, our first major theater piece. And that was it. And 600 plays later, here we are.
By the way, René Auberginois played Odo in the Star Trek series. Another big fan of his. So Babbitt was produced in studio, but a lot of your productions are recorded right from the stage.
Yes. So what happened was initially, there's a hotel in Santa Monica. It was called the Guest Quarters Suite Hotel in Santa Monica. And we had gotten in touch with them. The fellow who was running the hotel at the time was very kind of an interesting guy. And he reached out to us and said, would you be interested in doing, you know, recordings in front of the audience? And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. And they had a ballroom and they had a stage. And we started recording plays. We had no idea if anybody would be interested. So we sent out a big announcement, did a press release, and said we were going to record plays in front of the audience and people could come and watch. And every play was recorded four times, like Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I think two shows on Saturday and one on Sunday. And then we would edit to get the best result from each day of recording. Anyway, we announced it and people just responded like crazy. I mean, we had lines going out into the street, lining up at the guest quarter suite hotel to come and watch the recordings. And that launched it. And we were at guest quarters for many years. And then, of course, we transitioned to UCLA. We started it in LA, but then we expanded it. We went to Chicago. We recorded 80 plays in Chicago. We worked with the local radio station, the public radio station there. It was called Chicago Theaters on the Air. Then we went to Washington, D.C. This is all in the late 80s, early 90s. And then we went to Washington, D.C. We did Washington Theaters on the Air. We worked with the Voice of America and the Smithsonian Institution and recorded plays in the Voice of America Auditorium. Then we went up to Boston and did a whole series of plays in Boston. What happened was that we began to accumulate this library through all of these live recording adventures. And then we also continued to record plays in the studio. Up until the pandemic, we were at UCLA. We would record seven times a year, Friday night, Saturday two shows, Sunday afternoon, and then we would edit the shows together to make a great recording. Since the pandemic, of course, we have been had to have recorded. We record everything in studio, but we hope to go back to live performance with an audience in Los Angeles sometime in the next year.
So you're doing live performances, podcasts. You have the streaming service now available. People can find out more about that at latw.org. LA Theater Works. Well, is the LA related to Los Angeles? It sounds like you're in an international organization.
Of course. Of course. Yeah, there were times when people said, well, why do you call it LA Theater Works? You're a national organization. But, you know, this is our home. This is where we are.
Gotcha. And you're also doing high definition screenings from London, the London National Theater.
Yes. It started because we had an opportunity. We had a funder who was a very generous funder. We had done a terrific recording of The Importance of Being Earnest. And it was suggested to us that this funder said they would give us the money to actually make a film, just like the National Theater live films, of The Importance of Being Earnest. We did a recording on stage and we filmed it. And it's a terrific recording of The Importance of Being Earnest. And it's part of, at the same time, we were in touch with the National Theater and they had begun this program called NT Live, where they would film their productions and then make them available all over the world to people who wanted to producers who wanted to expose audiences worldwide to their things. And we took it on. We decided we would become a distributor of the National Theater Live Films. And to this day, we are at UCLA. They have fabulous screening facilities. And we show the National Theater Live films on a regular basis. People can just go on our website, latw.org, and they'll see the section that says NT Live, and they can buy tickets and come to the UCLA and see these wonderful screenings of the NT Live shows. But as I said, we did one ourselves, which was the Importance of Being Earnest. I'd like to talk about a couple of new initiatives that we have. The one that I'm very, very excited about is called the Play Club. And we are in, our recordings are in most libraries, most of the public libraries throughout the country. There's, you know, several thousand libraries, of course, public libraries, and we're basically in virtually all of them. And as you know, libraries have book clubs. And so I got the idea that we should start a play club, and we would work with libraries all over the country and make this available to them. The idea being, once a month, we would give the library or any participating library a play, a recording, which they could distribute free to any of their patrons who were interested. Then people would come in to the library on a scheduled day, or they could participate on Zoom. We would provide a list of discussion topics based on the play, and a librarian, one of the local librarians, would host the gathering. People could also, if a local library didn't want to do that, they could just have their patrons watch our hosting on Zoom, because we would do a hosting of the play and a discussion group, and people could access it on Zoom if they liked. So that project is set to debut sometime probably in January or February, and we're calling it the Play Club, based on the idea of book clubs. So it's a similar notion. So that's very exciting. And then we've launched in partnership with a company called Exceptional. You can have access to our entire library of almost 600 plays.
Well, it's great to support art organizations, particularly in this very challenging time. But there's also resources where you can get these plays for free in Los Angeles. Los Angeles Public Library has Canopy, and you can download them.
Absolutely. And you can, then there's a whole group of plays. There's about almost 40 plays, if you go on our website, that are absolutely free. You know, we have one of our great partnerships is with the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. And the Sloan Foundation has been a generous supporter of LA Theater Works for many years. And they're very interested in plays that with themes about science and technology. And we have recorded, I would say, there's about 28 to 30 plays that we have recorded that have science and technology themes. Those plays are on our website under the Sloan Foundation, and you can access those plays absolutely without charge. And many, many teachers, of course, take advantage of that. And they use the Sloan plays, which are terrific, terrific works that deal with issues around science and technology.
Well, I'm downloading them to my phone and listening in my car. And the thing is, I find them very addicting. Once you get into this, you just want to hear the next one and keep going from there. Well, Susan Loewenberg of LA Theater Works, latw.org. You know, theater is not only about entertainment, but culture and the past and the present, but also mainly about thought and getting people to think and consider and ideas, more important than ever in these changing times, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there is so much wisdom in a play, in a good play. You know, there's a lot of wisdom. At the same time, of course, a good play ropes you in, you know, and the information in good plays is so skillfully and beautifully integrated into the storyline. And I think that's the magic of theater. That is the magic.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for your time. We'll do this again.
Okay. Thank you.
Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis. The LA Classic Theatre Works presentation of the complete novel directed by Gordon Hunt. Babbitt will be heard in 29 installments, with the characters and narration performed by the following members of the L.A. Classic Theatre Works: Ed Asner, René Aubergenois, Bonnie Bedelia, Ed Begley Jr., Georgia Brown, Roscoe Lee Brown, Jack Coleman, Bud Cort, Ted Danson, William Devane, Richard Dreyfuss, Hector Elizondo, Fionnuala Flanagan, Robert Foxworth, Harry Hamlin, Julie Harris, Helen Hunt, Amy Irving, Stacey Keach, John Lithgow, Nan Martin, Marcia Mason, Richard Masser, Marion Mercer, Joanna Miles, Holly Palance, Judge Reinhold, Franklin Seals, David Selby, Ali Sheedy, Madeline Smith, James Whitmore, Joe Beth Williams, and Michael York. Ed Asner will be heard as George F. Babbitt, with Nan Martin as Myra Babbitt. Narrating in part one are Georgia Brown, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Foxworth, Amy Irving, Marcia Mason, and Joe Beth Williams. Part one, Babbitt, by Sinclair Lewis.
The towers of Zenith aspired above the morning mist, austere towers of steel and cement and limestone, sturdy as cliffs and delicate as silver rods. They were neither citadels nor churches, but frankly and beautifully, office buildings.
The mist took pity on the fretted structures of earlier generations, the post office with its shingle-tortured mansard, the red brick minarets of hulking old houses, factories with stingy and sooted windows, wooden tenements colored like mud. The city was full of such grotesqueries, but the clean towers were thrusting them from the business centers, and on the farther hills were shining new houses, homes they seemed for laughter and tranquility.
Over a concrete bridge fled a limousine of long, sleek hood and noiseless engine. These people in evening clothes were returning from an all-night rehearsal of a little theater play, an artistic adventure considerably illuminated by champagne. Below the bridge curved a railroad, a maze of green and crimson lights. The New York Flyer boomed past, and 20 lines of polished steel leaped into the glare.
In one of the skyscrapers, the wires of the Associated Press were closing down. The telegraph operators wearily raised their celluloid eyeshades after a night of talking with Paris and Peking. Through the building crawled the scrub women, yawning, their old shoes slapping. The dawn mist spun away. Queues of men with lunchboxes clumped toward the immensity of new factories, sheets of glass and hollow tile, glittering shops where 5,000 men worked beneath one roof, pouring out the honest wares that would be sold up the Euphrates and across the veldt. The whistles rolled out in greeting, a chorus cheerful as the April dawn, the song of labor in a city built, it seemed, for giants.
There was nothing of the giant in the aspect of the man who was beginning to awaken on the sleeping porch of a Dutch colonial house in that residential district of Zenith known as Floral Heights. His name was George F. Babbitt. He was 46 years old now, in April 1920, and he made nothing in particular, neither butter nor shoes nor poetry, but he was nimble in the calling of selling houses for more than people could afford to pay. His large head was pink, his brown hair thin and dry. His face was babyish in slumber, despite his wrinkles and the red spectacle dents on the slopes of his nose. He was not fat, but he was exceedingly well-fed. His cheeks were pads, and the unroughened hand which lay helpless upon the khaki-colored blanket was slightly puffy. He seemed prosperous, extremely married, and unromantic. And altogether unromantic appeared this sleeping porch, which looked on one sizable elm, two respectable grass plots, a cement driveway, and a corrugated iron garage. Yet Babbitt was again dreaming of the fairy child, a dream more romantic than scarlet pagodas by a silver sea. For years the fairy child had come to him. Where others saw but Georgie Babbitt, she discerned gallant youth. She waited for him in the darkness beyond mysterious groves. When at last he could slip away from the crowded house, he darted to her. His wife, his clamoring friends, sought to follow, but he escaped. The girl fleet beside him, and they crouched together on a shadowy hillside. She was so slim, so white, so eager. She cried that he was gay and valiant, but she would wait for him. that they would sail...
Rumble and bang of the milk truck. Babbitt moaned, turned over, struggled back toward his dream. He could see only her face now, beyond misty waters. The furnace man slammed the basement door. A dog barked in the next yard. As Babbitt sank blissfully into a dim, warm tide, the paper carrier went by whistling, and the rolled-up advocate thumped the front door. Babbitt roused, his stomach constricted with alarm. As he relaxed, he was pierced by the familiar and irritating rattle of someone cranking a Ford. Snap-a-ah, snap-a-ah, snap-a-ah. Himself a pious motorist, Babbitt cranked with the unseen driver. With him waited through taut hours for the roar of the starting engine. With him agonized as the roar ceased, and again began the infernal, patient snap-a-ah. A round, flat sound, a shivering, cold morning sound, a sound infuriating and inescapable. Not till the rising voice of the motor told him that the Ford was moving was he released from the panting tension. He glanced once at his favorite tree, elm twigs against the gold patina of sky, and fumbled for sleep as for a drug. He, who had been a boy very credulous of life, was no longer greatly interested in the possible and improbable adventures of each new day. He escaped from reality till the alarm clock rang at 7:20.
It was the best of nationally advertised and quantitatively produced alarm clocks, with all modern attachments, including cathedral chime, intermittent alarm, and a phosphorescent dial.
Babbitt was proud of being awakened by such a rich device.
Socially, it was almost as creditable as buying expensive cord tires.
He sulkily admitted now that there was no more escape, but he lay and detested the grind of the real estate business.
And disliked his family.
And disliked himself for disliking them.
The evening before, he had played poker at Virgil Gunch's till midnight, and after such holidays, he was irritable before breakfast.
It may have been the tremendous home-brewed beer of the Prohibition era, and the cigars to which that beer enticed him.
It may have been resentment of return from this fine, bold man world to a restricted region of wives and stenographers and of suggestions not to smoke so much.
From the bedroom beside the sleeping porch, his wife's detestably cheerful,
"Time to get up, Georgie boy!"
and the itchy sound, the brisk and scratchy sound of combing hairs out of a stiff brush.
He grunted.
He dragged his thick legs in faded baby blue pajamas from under the khaki blanket.
He sat on the edge of the cot, running his fingers through his wild hair while his plump feet mechanically felt for his slippers.
He looked regretfully at the blanket, forever a suggestion to him of freedom and heroism.
He had bought it for a camping trip which had never come off.
It symbolized gorgeous loafing.
Gorgeous cursing.
Virile flannel shirts. He creaked to his feet, groaning at the waves of pain which passed behind his eyeballs.
Though he waited for their scorching recurrence, he looked blurrily out at the yard. It delighted him, as always. It was the neat yard of a successful businessman of Zenith. That is, it was perfection and made him also perfect.
He regarded the corrugated iron garage. For the 365th time in a year, he reflected,
"No class of that tin shack. I have to build me a frame garage. By golly, it's the only thing on the place that isn't up to date."
While he stared, he thought of a community garage for his acreage development, Glen Oriole.
He stopped puffing and jiggling.
His arms were akimbo.
His petulant, sleep-swollen face was set in harder lines.
He suddenly seemed capable.
An official.
A man to contrive.
To direct.
To get things done.
On the vigor of his idea, he was carried down the hard, clean, unused-looking hall into the bathroom.
Though the house was not large, it had, like all houses on Floral Heights, an altogether royal bathroom of porcelain and glazed tile and metal sleek as silver.
The towel rack was a rod of clear glass set in nickel.
The tub was long enough for a Prussian guard, and above the set bowl was a sensational exhibit of toothbrush holder,
shaving brush holder,
soap dish,
sponge dish,
and medicine cabinet, so glittering and so ingenious that they resembled an electrical instrument board.
But the Babbitt, whose god was modern appliances, was not pleased. The air of the bathroom was thick with the smell of a heathen toothpaste.
"We're on a banana again. Instead of sticking a lily doll, like I've repeatedly asked her, she's gone and gotten some confounded stinkum stuff that makes you sick."
The bath mat was wrinkled and the floor was wet.
His daughter Verona eccentrically took baths in the morning now and then.
He slipped on the mat and slid against the tub. He said,
"Damn!"
Furiously, he snatched up his tube of shaving cream. Furiously, he lathered with a belligerent slapping of the unctuous brush. Furiously, he raked his plump cheeks with a safety razor. It pulled. The blade was dull. He said...
Damn! Oh, damn it!
He hunted through the medicine cabinet for a packet of new razor blades, reflecting as invariably...
It'd be cheaper to buy one of these dinguses and strop your own blades.
And when he discovered the packet, behind the round box of bicarbonate of soda, he thought ill of his wife for putting it there, and very well of himself for not saying, damn.
But he did say it immediately afterward, when with wet and soap-slippery fingers he tried to remove the horrible little envelope and crisp-clinging oil paper from the new blade.
Damn!
Then there was the problem, oft pondered, never solved, of what to do with the old blade, which might imperil the fingers of his young.
As usual, he tossed it on top of the medicine cabinet, with a mental note that someday he must remove the 50 or 60 other blades that were also temporarily piled up there.
He finished his shaving in a growing testiness, increased by his spinning headache and by the emptiness in his stomach.
When he was done, his round face smooth and streamy and his eyes stinging from soapy water, he reached for a towel.
The family towels were wet.
Wet and clammy and vile.
All of them wet, he found, as he blindly snatched them. His own face towel.
His wife's.
Verona's.
Ted's.
Tinka's.
And the lone bath towel with the huge welt of initial. Then George F. Babbitt did a dismaying thing.
He wiped his face on the guest towel.
It was a pansy-embroidered trifle, which always hung there to indicate that the Babbitts were in the best Floral Heights society.
No one had ever used it.
No guest had ever dared to.
Guests secretly took a corner of the nearest regular towel.
He was raging.
By golly, here they go and use up all the towels. Every doggone one of them. And they use them and get them all wet and sopping and never put out a dry one for me. Of course, I'm the goat. And then I want one, and I'm the only person in the doggone house that's got the slightest doggone bit of consideration for other people and thoughtfulness and consider there may be others that may want to use the doggone bathroom after me and consider...
He was pitching the chill abominations into the bathtub, pleased by the vindictiveness of that desolate flapping sound.
And in the midst, his wife serenely trotted in, observed serenely,
"Why, Georgie, dear, what are you doing? Are you going to wash out the towels?" Well, you needn't wash out the towels. Oh, Georgie, you didn't go and use the guest towel, did you?
It is not recorded that he was able to answer.
For the first time in weeks, he was sufficiently roused by his wife to look at her.
Myra Babbitt, Mrs. George F. Babbitt, was definitely mature. She had creases from the corners of her mouth to the bottom of her chin, and her plump neck bagged. But the thing that marked her as having passed the line was that she no longer had reticences before her husband, and no longer worried about not having reticences. She was in a petticoat now, and corsets which bulged, and unaware of being seen in bulgy corsets. She'd become so dully habituated to married life that in her full matronliness she was as sexless as an anemic nun. She was a good woman, a kind woman, a diligent woman, but no one, save perhaps Tinka, her 10-year-old, was at all interested in her, or entirely aware that she was alive. After a rather thorough discussion of all the domestic and social aspects of towels, she apologized to Babbitt for his having an alcoholic headache, and he recovered enough to endure the search for a BVD undershirt, which had, he pointed out, malevolently been concealed among his clean pajamas. He was fairly amiable in the conference on the brown suit.
What do you think, Myra?
He pawed at the clothes hunched on a chair in their bedroom while she moved about mysteriously adjusting and patting her petticoat and, to his jaundiced eye, never seeming to get on with her dressing.
How about it? Shall I wear the brown suit another day?
Well, it looks awfully nice on you.
I know, but gosh, it needs pressing.
That's so. Perhaps it does.
It certainly could stand being pressed, all right.
Yes, perhaps it wouldn't hurt it to be pressed.
Well, gee, the coat doesn't need pressing. No sense in having a whole darn suit pressed when the coat doesn't need it.
That's so.
But the pants certainly need it, all right. Look at them. Look at those wrinkles. The pants certainly do need pressing.
That's so. Oh, Georgie, why couldn't you wear the brown coat with the blue trousers? We were wondering what we'd do with them.
Good Lord! Did you ever in all my life know me to wear the coat of one suit and the pants of another? What do you think I am, a busted bookkeeper?
Well... why don't you put on the dark gray suit today and stop in at the tailor and leave the brown trousers?
Well, I certainly need them. Well, where the devil is that gray suit? Oh, yes, here we are.
He was able to get through the other crises of dressing with comparative resoluteness and calm.
His first adornment was the sleeveless dimity BVD undershirt in which he resembled a small boy humorlessly wearing a cheesecloth tabard at a civic pageant. He never put on BVDs without thanking the God of progress that he didn't wear tight, long, old-fashioned undergarments like his father-in-law and partner, Henry Thompson. His second embellishment was combing and slicking back his hair. It gave him a tremendous forehead, arching up 2 inches beyond the former hairline. But most wonder-working of all was the donning of his spectacles. There is character in spectacles. The pretentious tortoiseshell, the meek pince-nez of the schoolteacher, the twisted silver-framed glasses of the old villager. Babbitt's spectacles had huge, circular, frameless lenses of the very best glass. The earpieces were thin bars of gold. In them, he was the modern businessman, one who gave orders to clerks and drove a car and played occasional golf and was scholarly in regard to salesmanship. His head suddenly appeared not babyish, but weighty, and you noted his heavy, blunt nose, his straight mouth and thick, long upper lip, his chin over-fleshy but strong. With respect, you beheld him put on the rest of his uniform as a solid citizen.
The gray suit was well-cut, well-made, and completely undistinguished. It was a standard suit. White piping on the V of the vest added a flavor of law and learning. His shoes were black-laced boots, good boots, honest boots, standard boots, extraordinarily uninteresting boots. The only frivolity was in his purple knitted scarf. With considerable comment on the matter to Mrs. Babbitt, who, acrobatically fastening the back of her blouse to her skirt with a safety pin, did not hear a word he said, he chose between the purple scarf and a tapestry effect with stringless brown harps among blown palms, and into it he thrust a snakehead pin with opal eyes.
A sensational event was changing from the brown suit to the gray the contents of his pockets. He was earnest about these objects. They were of eternal importance, like baseball or the Republican Party. They included a fountain pen and a silver pencil, always lacking a supply of new leads, which belonged in the right-hand upper vest pocket. Without them, he would have felt naked. On his watch chain were a gold penknife, silver cigar cutter, 7 keys, the use of 2 of which he had forgotten, and, incidentally, a good watch. Depending from the chain was a large yellowish elk's tooth, proclamation of his membership in the Brotherly and Protective Order of Elks. Most significant of all was his loose-leaf pocket notebook, that modern and efficient notebook which contained the addresses of people whom he had forgotten, prudent memoranda of postal money orders which had reached their destinations months ago, stamps which had lost their mucilage, clippings of verses by T. Cholmondeley Frink, and of the newspaper editorials from which Babbitt got his opinions and his polysyllables. Notes to be sure and do things, which he did not intend to do, and one curious inscription, D-S-S-D-M-Y-P-D-F.
But he had no cigarette case. No one had ever happened to give him one, so he hadn't the habit, and people who carried cigarette cases he regarded as effeminate. Last, he stuck in his lapel the Boosters Club button. With the conciseness of great art, the button displayed 2 words, Boosters Pep. It made Babbitt feel loyal and important. It associated him with good fellows, with men who were nice and human and important in business circles. It was his VC, his Legion of Honor ribbon, his Phi Beta Kappa key. With the subtleties of dressing ran other complex worries.
I feel kind of punk this morning,
he said.
I think I had too much dinner last evening. You oughtn't to serve those heavy banana fritters.
But you asked me to have some.
I know, but I tell you, when a fella gets past 40, he has to look after his digestion. There's a lot of fellas that don't take proper care of themselves. I tell you, at 40, a man's a fool or his doctor. I mean, his own doctor. Folks don't give enough attention to this matter of dieting. Now, I think, of course, a man ought to have a good meal after the day's work. But it would be a good thing for both of us if we took lighter lunches.
But, Georgie, here at home I always do have a light lunch.
Meaning I make a hog of myself eating downtown? Yeah, sure. You'd have a swell time if you had to eat the truck that new steward hands out to us at the athletic club. But I certainly do feel out of sorts this morning. Funny. Got a pain down here on the left side? Well, no, that wouldn't be appendicitis, would it? Last night when I was driving over to Verge Gunch's, I felt a pain in my stomach, too. Right here it was. Kind of a sharp shooting pain, eh? Where'd that dime go to? Why'd you serve more prunes at breakfast? Of course, I eat an apple every evening. An apple a day keeps the doctor away. But still, you ought to have more prunes. Not all these fancy doodads.
The last time I had prunes, you didn't eat them.
Well, I didn't feel like eating them, I suppose. Matter of fact, I think I did eat some of them. Anyway, I tell you, it's mighty important. I was at a Verge Gunch just last evening. Most people don't take sufficient care of their digestion.
Shall we have the Gunches for our dinner next week?
Well, sure. You bet.
Now, see here, George. I want you to put on your nice dinner jacket that evening.
Rats. The rest of them won't want to dress.
Of course they will. You remember when you didn't dress for the Littlefield supper party, and all the rest did, and how embarrassed you were?
Embarrassed? Hell, I wasn't embarrassed. Everybody knows I can put on as expensive a tux as anybody else, and I should worry if I don't happen to have it on sometimes. All a darn nuisance anyway. All right for a woman that stays around the house all the time, but when a fellow's worked like the Dickens all day, he doesn't want to go and hustle his head off getting into the soup and fish for a lot of folks that he's seen in just regular ordinary clothes that same day.
You know you enjoy being seen in one. The other evening you admitted you were glad I'd insisted on your dressing. You said you felt a lot better for it. And, oh, Georgie, I do wish you wouldn't say tux. It's dinner jacket.
Rats, what's the odds?
Well, it's what all the nice folks say. Suppose Lucille McKelvey heard you calling it a tux.
Well, that's all right now. Lucille McKelvey can't put anything on me. Her folks are common as mud, even if her husband and her dad are millionaires. I suppose you're trying to rub in your exalted social position. Well, let me tell you that your revered paternal ancestor, Henry T., doesn't even call it a tux. He calls it a bobtail jacket for a ringtail monkey. And you couldn't get him into one unless you chloroformed him.
Now, don't be horrid, George.
Well, I don't want to be horrid, but Lord, you're getting as fussy as Verona. Ever since she got out of college, she's been too rambunctious to live with. Doesn't know what she wants. Well, I know what she wants. All she wants is to marry a millionaire and live in Europe and hold some preacher's hand and simultaneously at the same time stay right here in Zenith and be some blooming kind of a socialist agitator or boss charity worker or some damn thing. Lord! And Ted is just as bad. He wants to go to college and he doesn't want to go to college. Only one of the three that knows her own mind is Tinka. Simply can't understand how I ever came to have a pair of shilly-shallying children like Roan and Ted. I may not be any Rockefeller or James J. Shakespeare, but I certainly do know my own mind. And I do keep right on plugging along in the office. And do you know the latest? Far as I can figure out, Ted's new B is he'd like to be a movie actor and... And here I've told him 100 times, if he'll go to college and law school and make good, I'll set him up in business. And Verona just exactly as bad. Doesn't know what she wants. Well, well, come on. Aren't you ready yet? The girl rang the bell 3 minutes ago.
Before he followed his wife, Babbitt stood at the westernmost window of their room. This residential settlement, Floral Heights, was on a rise. And though the center of the city was 3 miles away, Zenith had between 300,000 and 400,000 inhabitants now, he could see the top of the Second National Tower, an Indiana limestone building of 35 stories. Its shining walls rose against April sky to a simple cornice, like a streak of white fire. Integrity was in the tower, and decision. It bore its strength lightly as a tall soldier. As Babbitt stared, the nervousness was soothed from his face, his slack chin lifted in reverence. All he articulated was,
"That's one lovely sight."
But he was inspired by the rhythm of the city, his love of it renewed. He beheld the tower as a temple spire of the religion of business, a faith passionate, exalted, surpassing common men. And as he clumped down the stairs to breakfast, he whistled the ballad, "Oh, by gee, by gosh, by jingo," as though it were a hymn, melancholy and noble.
Babbitt, Part 1 by Sinclair Lewis.
it now. So let's tell the world about it now. Happy days are here again. Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. So let us sing a song of happy cheer again. Happy, happy, happy days are here again.
Coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed Susan Loewenberg, the producing director of LA Theater Works, latw.org, and I played an excerpt from Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis, one of their signature works. At the very beginning, Minnie the Moocher by Cab Calloway, and we just wrap things up with Happy Days Are Here Again, Ben Selvin and his orchestra, from the period that Babbitt was set in. We'll be back next week with the very best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.